Alaska is a state of tremendous diversity. Home to half of the nation's tribes, there are also growing populations of citizens from countries across the world. Good morning, I'm Lori Townsend. There are some journalists of color in Alaska, but not many. This year, the University of Alaska Anchorage Atwood Chair of Journalism is the first Native to hold the position. Are we making progress in diversifying Alaska's newsrooms? What changes when reporters come from the ethnic communities they report on? UAA Atwood Chair Mark Trahant is my guest on this edition of Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922, on the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us today for Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, your host for the next few weeks while Steve Heimel is on vacation. Mark Trahant is my guest this morning. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Mark has been an editor and reporter since he was a teenager on the Fort Hall Reservation in Idaho. Mark is this year's Atwood Chair of Journalism at UAA. We're going to be talking about diversity in newsrooms and why that matters. Mark, first give us a bit of background and what you plan to focus on during your time at UAA.
Well, I have both a traditional and an unconventional career. The traditional side is I started in tribal newspapers working at the Choban News and was editor of the Navajo Times when it was a daily newspaper. I worked at the Salt Lake Tribune where I was a senior editor, the Moscow Pullman Daily News, where I was a publisher, and Seattle Times as a columnist, and Seattle Post-Intelligencer as the editor of the editorial page. So pretty wide varied. Since the PI died, I've really engaged in social media and have written a lot about healthcare reform as a Kaiser Media Fellow. And lately, the last couple of years, I've been blogging pretty intensely about austerity and how that's changing, particularly Indian country, but really society.
Mm-hmm. Your book, The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, deals with bringing federal Indian policy into the spotlight. Senator Henry Jackson of Washington State was changing his ideas, at least publicly, about tribal self-determination. Tell us about why you wrote that book. I think it's sort of a good way into the discussion of insights that might be missed by reporters who are not connected to tribal or other ethnic communities.
Well, first, let me echo that. I've heard from a number of reporters who covered Henry Jackson over the years who sent me notes after the book came out and said, I had no idea about this story. And it just was off their radar. So I think that's exactly right. Henry Jackson is fascinating. He was elected to Congress after World War II and then the Senate, particularly in his House years, but then again in his Senate years. He was part of a wave in the 1950s called Termination. And the idea was that the federal government should just throw up its hands and get out of the Indian business and have no relations at all with tribal governments. And the evidence became really clear quickly that that was a failure as a policy. It didn't work on many, many levels. And Henry Jackson came to that conclusion, and he had kind of had as a mentor and almost a father figure, a man by the name of Clinton Anderson from New Mexico. And Anderson was a strong proponent of termination, and he had promised, he had helped Jackson be elevated to chairman of the Interior Committee. And as part of that deal, he promised that he would keep the staff intact. And one of the key staff members was a man who was basically writing termination into every bill that came through the committee. So Jackson knew he had to get rid of him. And this story basically tells how he did that and replaced him with the first Native American on the Hill, Forrest Gerard, who then the partnership between Jackson and Girard launched this really extraordinary period of Indian history where major Indian legislation just rolled out of the Congress, ranging from the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act to Indian Self-Determination Act. And that's particularly important in Alaska because I don't think really any state has used the Indian Self-Determination Act like Alaska. You see it every day in things like the Alaska Native Medical Center as a prime example of a law that worked.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in the Anchorage area, you can call us at 550-8422, 550-8422. We're talking about diversity in newsrooms, in reporting, and in Alaska. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mark, with that backdrop of your book, The Last Great Battle of the Indian Wars, as kind of a good example of why it's important to have other viewpoints, let's talk about that, the need for diversity in newsrooms. What changes when newsrooms better reflect the populations they're reporting on?
Well, they do two things. They connect better with their readers and audience in a way that helps explain a complex society. And it's so easy. You have to go back to pre-World War II, and there was a really remarkable report by Robert Maynard Hutchins, who was then the president and chancellor of the University of Chicago. And Hutchins and his team came to the conclusion that a working democracy cannot survive unless it hears from all of its voices. And the way they framed that was that one of the problems with the press, and this was in the 1940s, was that too often actions of a group, he called them constituent groups, but basically minority groups, are taken as a sample action as the way it is for everything. And they're taken without context. And he thought the most important thing the news media could do was to add context to those stories and explain why sample action is so important. And more than 60 years later, we're still faced with that challenge as a democracy, is how to listen to all those constituent groups in a society.
Well, and also when you talk about the constituent groups, there's a lot of subgroups too. You can't just say Alaska Native people think this way, right, or Native people across the country support this or that. What would you recommend then to a reporter trying to do a good job of covering diverse viewpoints, but realizing that you can't take one spokesperson and think that that's representative of a lot of diverse viewpoints?
Right. Well, the first thing is to recognize that it's complicated and that there is not one particular view on anything. I think it starts with just hanging out. Too often, reporting is done in a crisis mode, and you drop into a community, and you're expecting to do it all at once and to get nuance on a short time frame, and that's just not going to happen. So sometimes it's good just to go to a community, hang out, not write anything, just learn and listen.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like that in itself, I know from my experience reporting in tribal communities in the Midwest for a number of years, it took quite a while before, and also I think it depends on who you go with and how you approach people. It took a number of years before I had the kind of access that a reporter would want as a non-Native person, a white reporter coming into communities. It took a while to be able to gain that trust and people realize that I didn't have some weird agenda about what I was doing. If you've had an experience, good or bad, with reporters in Alaska, give us a call. Let us know what you think about the need for diversity in the news in our reporting. We have half the nation's tribes in Alaska. We have a tremendously diverse population, more than 90 languages spoken in the Anchorage School District. One of the most diverse schools in the country is right here in the Mountain View neighborhood. So there's no lack of diverse populations in the state, yet only a handful of reporters across the state that are either Native or Black journalists, Asian journalists, journalists of color. Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255 or locally 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, to join our conversation about diversity in newsrooms. How will you, you're the Atwood Chair of Journalism at UAA this year, how will you promote the work that while you're at UAA and visiting communities across the state, what do you plan to carry as the message about the need for diversity in news?
Well, I think I'd focus mostly on individuals and basically look for talent and then support them and try to build up their contacts, their ability to succeed. And I think success breeds more success, so you find people and help them out and set up opportunities and let them do with it what they will.
So you plan to actively seek out some reporters in the Native community here?
Right, or future reporters, absolutely.
Sure. You've had to sort of, you've definitely had to become very creative in your own right as an independent journalist after the Seattle PI went away. And you had to, as you said, you started spending a lot of time developing your network on social media. How has that changed the way in which reporters can do their work? You and I have talked about how it's possible now for someone in a remote place, if they have good internet connection, to actually be kind of a one-person news service. Tell us about your thoughts on that and how that might help in places like rural Alaska, where there's a lack of cohesive communications in communities, and maybe there's somebody out there that is just really the person that could be doing that in a region and could possibly help us with the network of reporters that we have through APRN.
Oh, absolutely. One of the ways that technology has changed and social media has changed things is the ability of somebody to operate independently with very little equipment. An iPod and a microphone, and you have a full radio station and the potential to go on air live. There's all kinds of things you can do with that technology. So it becomes then a will of imagination. How far do you want to stress? And I think the other thing for a rural community is that for the first time, it provides a new opportunity for somebody to stay. You don't have to go away to practice your craft. You don't have to move to Anchorage. You don't have to move to Washington, D.C., you can learn the craft locally and come up with story ideas locally and find a broader audience in ways that you weren't able to do that. Every 4 days, there's more videos posted on YouTube than the entire history of the world. And that volume is crazy in a way, but that volume shows that if you get the right idea, the opportunity is just unlimited.
I remember when I was working in news at Le Coudre, the Le Coudre Ojibwe Reservation in northern Wisconsin, and I was the news director there, and the general manager, I told him that I would only take the job if we could work to get someone from Le Coudre to work me out of the job, because I felt strongly that somebody from Le Coudre should have that position on the reservation. In 7 years, I didn't have success with that. Had a few candidates, but it didn't work. It seems to me that one of the basic problems is that if you can't make some money, you can't stay with it, no matter how idealistic you may be or how much you realize the need is there in your community. And that was always a constant struggle. Do you see that there's new pathways for reporters with new media now to perhaps make some money so that they can stay in those small communities and make it work?
I think there are, but I think that's really the challenge, and I think it's a hard one. Any writer has to focus on what pays the bills as well as your craft, and that tension has really existed since the beginning of probably the pen, and it hasn't changed. I think there are more opportunities, but I think it really requires you to hustle and think and to try to look for new ways to do it. I just saw a magazine that actually does some really interesting work. It's in Washington State, and they decided to replace the editor, and I saw the salary that went with the editing job, and I looked at it and I thought, how can anyone afford to live in that community on that salary? So I think that remains a huge challenge. I know public radio has that problem in general because it's a lot of it's volunteer based, and it's great for volunteers to get involved and do things. But if you're going to make it a career, You need to have more than that. It's true for freelancers. Freelancers look at per word basis, and they've got to figure out then how to transfer that into some sort of living. I've been really experimenting with something very different as an approach. And the primary vehicle for what I'm working on is a weekly column and daily poems. And those I give away for free, and media can use them without any compensation at all. But when then I do a project, if a newspaper or an organization calls me and wants something, then the fee tends to be pretty high. So I use that high fee to subsidize my free work, and the high fee then comes in a lot less often, but hopefully pays the bills.
Sure. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call to join our conversation. Locally, it's 550-8422, or you can email your questions to talk@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a call from Fairbanks. Matthew's on the line with us. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can. Did you have a question?
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm a freelance. I'm native, and I'm a freelance journalist, and I'm currently writing for First Alaskans. And a lot of what you guys are saying is very relevant to what I've been faced with and thinking about. I have a number of comments on newspaper reporting on Native issues. First of all, I'm not going to name names, of course, but there's like certain newspapers in Alaska that the thing I see wrong with them is that they tend to expound on the negativities of Native people and Native issues. And so when I was writing articles, I tried to balance it and focus it on like them as like us as like people that are really genuinely trying. And when I did that, it resonated really well with everyone. And second, when I got a little too radical or a little too political, they tended to like not publish my things. And I just think that's wrong. I think there needs to be a real honest and good diverse voice in the media. Because I like what that gentleman there said when he said a working democracy never works without a diverse voice in the in journalism. So and freelance journalism could really bring jobs to villages in Alaska, rural Alaska, where employment is obviously really needed. That's all I want to say.
Well, thank you, Matthew, for that. I was interested in learning a little more about what he meant by radical political comments there. I think, you know, there's a need for diversity in comments, but of course there's always a need to be fair in your approach. And all of us, because of our personal experiences and the way that we were raised, you and I were talking about there's really no impartiality to journalism as much as there is an effort to try to make sure that you're being fair and reasonable in your approach, because everyone has a life experience that shapes their opinions and their ideas about things. And our work as journalists is to try to keep that out of the stories that we tell. Would you agree, Mark?
Absolutely. I think fairness is the most important goal in every story. And that's true of whether it's an opinion piece or straight news piece. I would also mention to Matthew that I think it's really important for journalists from Indian country to join the Native American Journalists Association and to get connected with other journalists trying to do the same thing and hear their stories. And you know, maybe it's not physically being there, but just connecting to that network is really critically important, because once you explain what you're doing and what you're trying to do and the challenges you have working with the papers that you just mentioned, others can say, well, you know, I had that same experience and here's how we dealt with it.
I can understand why there might be a feeling, especially from a younger person's perspective, of maybe some anger or at least frustration at the imbalance in what is covered and what is reported. And so I can see why a younger person would feel like, okay, well, I've got to really get my stuff out there because I've got to try to counteract some of the other that's coming at us. But there's right and wrong ways to do that. Is that something that you'll spend time trying to talk to some of these angry young people about as you make your way across the state?
Well, I hope young people have that kind of passion, so I'm not going to discourage it.
Yeah, I'm not. No, I
right.
would not.
No, I think, they're sure there's approaches.
Sure.
There's great avenues now, though. If there's an obstacle in traditional media, now you can go around it. So it doesn't mean that's the end of the story. You can develop. Basically, I think what it boils down to is developing a strategy for how you want your story told and what your audience is going to be and how you're going to reach them.
Mark Trahant is the UAA, University of Alaska Anchorage, Atwood Chair of Journalism this year. Mark is the first Native person to hold the Atwood Chair. And we're talking about diversity in newsrooms and why that's important. We're going to take another caller from Anchorage. This is Tim. Hi, Tim. You have a comment about student journalists?
Yeah, a comment and kind of a question. I'm a student journalist at UAA, and I have the pleasure of learning with Mark Trahant. And how has a journalist sort of working as the ethnic majority in a newsroom, how can I tell stories that resonate with, I think you called them smaller constituent groups, but, how can I, as a white journalist per se, go out and really tell stories that matter to all of the smaller subgroups in Alaska?
Thank you, Tim. Great question. I think it's really important that you're even asking that question, because I think it recognizes that we all have something to learn in this. And to me, that's what it boils down to, is just taking the time to learn a community and to learn the nuance of a community and the tone of a community and how stories are told in a community. And that means not maybe rushing for the first deadline story, but just taking time to listen and get to know people.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call, 1-800-478-TALK. In the Anchorage area, you can call 550-8422 or email us talk@alaskapublic.org. I think that instead of, as we talked about earlier, instead of parachuting in when there's an emergency or some scandal or something happening in a community, the need to spend time in the communities that you will be reporting on that may be part of your beat can't be stressed strongly enough. It makes such a difference to go, if you're a student reporter or you're just into journalism, to actually go to the communities or the neighborhoods, if you're a metro reporter, an urban reporter, go to the neighborhoods that you'll be reporting on and spend time there just talking to people when you're not on deadline. Figuring out who you can get good information from is vital. And that's the same thing in Native communities or other communities of color. It may be a little longer path when you're a white journalist just bopping into the ethnic market and saying, hey, what's going on? But that's how it starts. And that's what it takes to be a good reporter. It's really applying the same tools of good journalism that you would do work anywhere, wouldn't you say, Mark?
Right. And it really starts with curiosity. I mean, what drives journalists is being curious. And satisfying that curiosity is never ending. There's always one more question, always one more thing that they'd like to know. Probably the main difference between a curious journalist is once we find out, we want to blab it. We want to go tell somebody. But it's that same process. And it's just I think it's the one thing that you can't teach. People are curious. And if it just bubbles up because they're so curious that they want to keep asking.
In the past, there was a lot of mistakes in reporting on Native communities and other ethnic communities, communities of color. Some of it, most of it, I would say, was probably just simple mistakes and wasn't malicious. Some of it was because saying certain things sells copy. An example that I have from Alaska is reporting on a community called named Brevik Mission up near Nome. and they, during the 1800s flu pandemic, they were a community that had a mass grave, like a lot of communities had, and a pathologist went there at one point in time to actually excavate and try to recreate the virus. The people there were concerned that opening that grave could possibly release the virus again, a very valid concern in my mind. At the time, an LA Times reporter wrote that the people of the community were afraid evil spirits would get out of the grave. Now, that was created wholly out of his brain, and I'm sure it sounded sexy and worked well with his editor, but was actually a lie. Mm-hmm. The people there were not concerned about that. They knew what the concern was. How hard has it been to overcome just those things, that inherent mistrust that sort of exists? I imagine to some degree still today. What do you hear when you visit Native communities about their lack of faith, or perhaps maybe now growing faith in getting it right in stories and news?
I think that's an important narrative. There are really two important narratives. And the first is that distrust because of things that have gotten wrong over the years, or, I mean, to tap into this mythical experience that may or not be part of the story. Often it's not. The second narrative that I think is equally important, though, is the one we need to remind people. And that is, if you look at the history, at the same time that was going on, there was also a history of the press being absolutely essential to getting the story out. And those two things have kind of worked hand in hand. So it's not one or the other, it's both. Mm-hmm. And you can look at the whole Northwest fishing rights dispute with the Bolt decision. The tribes in Washington and Oregon would never have gotten the kind of decision they got. And then later, moving beyond that decision in terms of public discourse, without the media being a very important part of the discussion.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Talk of Alaska. We're talking about diversity in the news today. Mark Trahant, UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism, is my guest on today's program. And before we take a break, we're going to hear from Roger in White Mountain. Good morning, Roger.
Oh, good morning. I have a short comment. Natives in general haven't been in an academic system as long as some Western cultures. Rural Alaska is the least developed sector of America. It seems like Western cultures don't take it seriously. Does that have anything to do with a very small population? Anything? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Well, I should mention, as a matter of self-disclosure, that I'm not an academic. I'm a journalist and just here in that capacity, and I'm thankful for that every day. But I do think the broader point is important, that there needs to be more respect for the embodiment of knowledge that has come from tribal communities that has a long history and an equally valid history, and it's something that should be listened to. And I think that's more and more happening, particularly in the academy.
And also in science, there's a growing recognition in science that traditional knowledge is science.
Absolutely.
And I think that has helped advance this whole concept into news reports and coverage as well. We are going to take a short break. And when we get back, we'll be talking with Mark Trahant, the UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism. And we'll be taking your calls. Have you had a good experience or a bad experience? Are you from either one of the tribes here in Alaska or an ethnic community, a community of color? And give us a call and let us know what your experience has been with the press and coverage of issues in your community as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. ERA, for more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
And by the newly restored Historic Anchorage Hotel. You can find out more about this boutique hotel in the heart of downtown at historicanchoragehotel.com.
Welcome back. I'm Lori Townsend, your host today for Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about diversity in newsrooms and the importance of news reporters, newsrooms reflecting the communities that they report on so that there's more accuracy and a lot more diversity in the stories themselves. My guest today is Mark Trahant. Mark is the Atwood Chair of Journalism for the University of Alaska Anchorage, right here in Anchorage. You can join our conversation if you have questions or comments. The number to call statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're calling in the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. And you can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Mark, I remember once many years ago when I was still really learning about how the reflections of people in media, how important that is. And having grown up as a white person, I didn't have that understanding until I spent a lot of time at Le Couturier and with Native people and began to realize, wow, not everyone sees themselves the way that I see myself reflected back in popular culture and in media. Minnie Two Shoes was the person that really helped me understand that, because she said, I want young people to see themselves in positive ways being reflected in media, and then I'll know that we're having success in getting our stories and the importance of who we are out there. And that really stuck with me because, as I said, I think that's one of those white privilege things that you don't really understand. It's a subtle thing. You don't understand that when you see yourself everywhere, you don't realize that other people don't. How much do you think, how far have we gotten in that respect? I know you can't really give a percentage to what it is, but we are there is progress being made, but how well do you think we're doing generally?
It depends on the medium. I think in print, there's been pretty substantial progress over time. And I think this latest wave of media retraction has been unfortunate because there were a lot of Native Americans who were right at the point where they would have been the editor of a paper or the publisher of a paper or basically the CEO. And when the collapse happened, that didn't occur. And that was kind of a problem. Television, I'm really disappointed in, because we just haven't broken that barrier in really any ways. In one of my books, it's called the, I can't remember the name of it. It's bad. At any rate, I'll think of it in a minute, senior moment. One of my books, I tell the story about Tana Beebe. And Tana was came out of a program in Columbia, at Columbia University, where she was brought into television reporting and kind of thrown into it. And she was hired at a Seattle television station. And this was in an era when not only were Native Americans not on television, but women weren't on television. And the news team there really didn't like the idea of her being hired, and they didn't like the idea of her taking away what they thought was their livelihood. So the news director at the time reacted by giving her the most ugly story of the day, whether it was that day's murder, whatever the tough story of that particular day was, hoping that she would kind of get grossed out and quit the business. And inadvertently, what he did was a great favor to her, because he gave her the lead story every day. And in a very short period of time, she is on every day with the lead story at the 5 or 6 o'clock news, and suddenly becoming an icon. And the further story is that there was a young Nez Perce girl who was watching all of this on television every day and saw herself, and her name was Hattie Kaufman, and she went on to being the first network correspondent from Indian Country, because she saw on local TV someone that looked like her, and it made her want to do that.
I referenced Minnie Two Shoes, who is no longer with us, but she was an amazing person and a great reporter, a Assiniboine Sioux woman, big, tall, really full of energy all the time. And I learned a lot from her working with her.
Minnie was amazing.
Yeah, she definitely had a great tenure as a journalist for many years. And felt very passionately about the issues that needed to be covered in Native communities. Mark, one of the programs that you worked on was a frontline program called The Silence, and that brought you to Alaska. Tell us about how you got involved in that project and what role you played.
I first received a call from the senior producer from Frontline, David Fanning, and his pitch basically was that needed a journalist to be part of the story. And they had two really good filmmakers who had been working on the story for a long time, but they were looking at more as a film story than as a journalism piece, and Frontline is very focused on the journalism. My inclination was to not get involved. It's just a complex story involving sexual abuse, subject that I have not explored a lot. And it didn't take long, though, thinking it through, that I really wanted to get involved. And it's one of those stories where I'm really grateful that I did, because I just learned so much from the people involved in the story and the communities. And ended up being really a life-changing experience in that sense.
Is there a burden when you are a Native journalist? And I could ask the same question with other journalists of color. Is there sort of a burden that goes with that, that there's a set of expectations that somehow your reporting will be different, both from the Native side and the non-Native side?
I don't think I've ever looked at it that way. Early in my career, when I was a reporter at the Arizona Republic, folks used to say that I couldn't write a straight lead to save my life. So I always looked at stories differently anyway. And it's just how I looked at the world. And when it came, and I had really one of the most extraordinary jobs at the Republic. It was to cover the West, and so it stretched from Alaska to Louisiana. And I would just pitch a story and hop on a plane. And within that, I was able to carve out major Indian stories as they kind of popped up in the region. So it was part of a broader matrix. It wasn't just covering Indian affairs. I think somehow the challenge in this diversity issue is to make it so that young Natives can do what they want to do. And sometimes that might mean covering sports. Sometimes that might mean covering police. Sometimes that might mean covering Indian issues or Native issues. It's got to be that broad acceptance of letting someone's talent come to the top.
So they shouldn't just be relegated to covering the powwows that come to town.
Exactly. I mean, they need to follow what they're going to be good at.
What other reporters would naturally gravitate to.
Right.
1-800-478-8255. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to join our conversation about diversity in news today. You can also call locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. Or email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. My guest today, I'm Lori Townsend, and my guest today is Mark Trahant, who is the UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism. Mark, you said recently in another discussion that we had that Native people have a right, but also a responsibility to tell their stories. What do you mean by that?
If you think about a history of 10,000 years in concert with this land, there's a certain responsibility to protect that land. And part of that protection requires that you tell your side of the story involved. One, for example, is, again, in the Northwest, because I spent so much time in Washington State. What really happened, Washington was as divided as anywhere in the country prior to the 1970s, where tribes were seen as basically taking too many fish and destroying the natural environment. And what happened was when the Supreme Court affirmed the right of tribes to fish in usual and accustomed manners, it forced a management scheme where tribes and the state shared resources. And once that happened, it made it better for everybody. And now there are salmon in places that haven't been in really half a century or more, and they're starting to recover in ways that are pretty significant. That story never would have been told had not tribal voices stepped up and said, we need to tell this story about why salmon matter and about why we need to keep fishing through this.
When I worked at Le Couturier LCO, the tribal chairman at that time really understood the power of the radio station on the reservation and how it could help do that cross-cultural promotion of talking about issues. You mentioned the fishing kind of the wars in the Pacific Northwest. There was also a similar case in the Midwest, as you're well aware, when Judge Barbara Crabb reaffirmed off-reservation treaty spearing rights, and it was a tremendous controversy. There were a lot of conflicts at boat landings. It's actually amazing no one was killed during those times. Le Couturier and WOJB, the station there, did a lot of work bringing together really angry sports fishing people and tribal people to have those conversations back and forth. And that was a good insight into how these types of media can help promote a rational and calm discussion in a really heated sense. Why else is it important to have ethnic press, ethnic media, rather than just the local paper covering the issues that some tribal papers or ethnic, there's some ethnic papers here in town, there's papers around the country, News from Indian Country is one, Indian Country Today is another one. Why are those important?
A community needs to have a voice within a community, and I think that's what the ethnic press does. One of the ways I've looked at it since I was a very young editor was what news gets clipped and put on the refrigerator, and what do families think is important, what do they want their kids to think is important, and that's something that's generally, the smaller the paper, the better, basically, that it gets down to that real local level of someone won a boxing tournament, someone won a baseball tournament, and it gets put on the fridge, and that's a mark of success, and that's really important. I want to just mention your other point I think is really important, and that is that sometimes the role of the media ought to be to remind us what we have in common rather than to focus on the differences. And I think, again, this is where diverse voices can play such a crucial role to say, look, yes, it's a little different here, but here's some things that are in common that we share. Folks in rural communities share far more than they don't. And just reminding people about that, I think, is really important.
It almost seems as if, even though we went through kind of a devastating time in journalism with the decimation of newsrooms across the country, that we may be entering an era where there's a lot of terminology being thrown around, hyper-local and things like that. Some of the problems that newspapers had was that some of them got too big and weren't relevant enough to their very local communities. Do you think that we might be entering a time that it's sort of this golden age of doing hyper-local journalism in combination with the tools that you were talking about earlier, social media, if you have internet access, you can do pretty much anything from anywhere. What do you think we'll be seeing in the next decade with small local community press and journalistic efforts?
This probably gets us into a two-hour conversation, but I think one of the changes going on in society that is pretty important is a shift in the structure of governance. And right now, so much of our national conversation is what's been going on in Washington, D.C., and how that filters down. And that's all important. But at the same time, what's going on across the country in very different ways is the creation and magnification of the city-state, where cities are growing in importance as regional economic hubs, and they're already contributing far more to the economy than what's occurring at the national level. And that whole rethinking of the role of a city-state in how it influences our actions, I think, is going to be really important. Demographers have really noticed this for the last decade, that cities are growing in influence in ways that they really haven't before in this country's history anyway.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255 if you'd like to join our conversation. I guess everyone's so interested in what you have to say, they're just not calling in today, Mark. Or locally, 550-8422 is the number in the Anchorage area if you'd like to join our conversation, if you have questions or comments about the need for diversity in newsrooms. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Howard Rock, many years ago, developed the Tundra Times sort of out of a newsletter, and initially it was an effort to communicate better among communities at a time when there wasn't Twitter and things like that. But it sort of evolved into this paper that took on some really serious issues. The Project Chariot proposal, this pretty wild idea to blow up a harbor with nuclear bombs, and also the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act issue, the land claims. And as that was building momentum, there was a lot of communication in Howard Rock's paper. What do you think, I mean, this is just wild speculation, but how different do you think things would be today if there had been more of a robust ethnic Native press presence during those negotiations, during those times? We talked a bit about the termination era and some of the stories that weren't being told at that time. If we turned it upside down and there were more Native and ethnic reporters as opposed to white reporters, what do you think would be different today in terms of policy and other things?
Well, termination was a good, important era where the press did not play a role, and I think that shows the danger. Although in the end of termination actually came about because of Native press, in part. The last battle for termination, and I tell this in my book, happened on the Colville Reservation in Washington State. And that reservation had elected a pro-termination tribal council and was getting ready to talk about breaking up the reservation and distributing the assets and going out of business, basically. And a very determined tribal council member by the name of Lucy Covington, who I actually think was probably the greatest Indian leader of the 20th century, started a campaign to change that and to get people educated about what was at stake, what the resources were, what it meant to be a tribal community. One of her key tools was the creation of a newspaper called Our Heritage. And Our Heritage actually, every edition would talk to people about what was going on in the community, what termination meant. And she actually had this crazy idea of rounding up national Native journalists and saying, come to Colville and help us out. And she was able to talk people like Chuck Trimble and Vine Deloria and others to help them in the cause and write about what was at stake. It was a really remarkable period of history. When she put together a slate of candidates for the Colville Tribal Council, and when they won that election, termination was over at Colville. And really, that was the end of termination in the country. Once Colville rejected it so soundly, it never again became a threat in the country.
So it's an excellent example of the power of the press.
Right. I mean, she was one person on a council that was bent on self-destruction.
We are going to take another short break. And when we get back, we'd love to take your calls about diversity in reporting, diversity in newsrooms across Alaska and across the country. My guest is Mark Trahant, UAA Atwood Chair for Journalism. We'll take your calls and continue our conversation as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. And by photographer Brian Adams, with the opening of his exhibit and the release of his new book, I Am Alaskan, An Exploration of Identity, at the Alaska Native Arts Foundation, 5 p.m. Friday, November 1st.
Welcome back. This is Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, your host today. We're talking about diversity in newsrooms and in reporting. Mark Trahant, UAA Atwood Chair for Journalism, is my guest on today's program. I'm going to turn my mic just a little bit here because I want to read an email. There's a question here from Nellie Moore. Mark, I'm sure you know Nellie's name. She is asking a question about news, about the fact that little news comes out of rural Alaska because radio stations and papers are underfunded. It's always a struggle, and a lot of the, even the APRN stations at one time had a lot more reporting staff than they do now, and people are still filling large news holes with fewer and fewer reporters. So people are working really hard. It makes it harder to get to some of the stories. One of the things that she's asking is, she says, I've seen corporations, some of the ANCs, Alaska Native Corporations Fund, travel to the bush if they're showcasing developments in telecommunications or health. Is this type of funding unethical, or how can it be used in a way that allows for balanced coverage? And she's talking about some of the trips that reporters have taken up to the Red Dog Mine that's owned by NANA, some other places that maybe you couldn't get to if you didn't go with the corporation that owns that enterprise. What do you think about those types of trips and the stories that may or may not come out of them?
Boy, I'd have to know more details, but in general, I think it's really important that journalists be absolute transparent about their source of funding. And so if that's the case, it needs to be part of the story throughout. I also think it's really important that as part of that process, you make sure you're talking to people with dissent so that you're not just getting one particular story, but you're hearing multiple versions of that story from different points of view. And if you're taking money in on a trip where you're going to be going at 11:15, talking to this group, at 11:30, this group, 11:45, this group, you're probably not going to get that dissent. And that might be a reason alone not to do it. Mm-hmm. It's something I think you have to think through very carefully and weigh the pros and cons and let readers know what's at stake.
1-800-478-8255. We only have a few minutes left, so I don't know how many more calls we'll probably get in, but we're going to take a call from Mark right now in Bethel. Hi, Mark.
Hi, good morning, Lori. Thanks for taking my call.
Good morning.
I caught a little bit of the show. It sounded like you were talking about the Tundra Times there, and the Tundra Times really did have a powerful impact on Project Chariot and on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, developing and maintaining debate within Alaska. And the real story of the Tundra Times is well told. How it got started is well told in Dan O'Neill's book, The Firecracker Boys. And it should be a real point of pride for all Alaskans and Alaska Natives, how kind of the original Alaska Native media started. But I'm interested in hearing Mark's comments, what his observations have been on current Alaska Native-owned media. We have a weekly newspaper here in Bethel, Delta Discovery, that's Alaska Native-owned. We have a chain of newspapers that's Alaska Native-owned. There's First Alaska Magazine. We have, I think, a fairly robust Alaska Native media. It, of course, could be bigger and could maybe be making more money. But and just really briefly, I want to if you haven't mentioned her, kind of give a shout out to Sharon McConnell, who is, I believe, the first Alaska Native television newscaster in the state, and
that's
really
right.
Was a role model for a lot of Alaska Native journalists. So I'd just be interested in hearing what his observations so far are on, about Alaska Native owned media here in the state.
Well, thanks, Mark. Thanks for bringing up Sharon's name. As I mentioned, Nellie Moore called in or sent an email in earlier, another Alaska Native journalist, one of the first here in the state, and Sharon McConnell was the first Alaska Native on television. What are your thoughts about Mark's comments?
I think he's exactly on point. I do want to mention one more thing, though, about Tundra Times before I go on to that. I think it's important. The Firecracker Boys is a great book, but I would also recommend Lael Morgan's biography of Howard Rock. And I also think it's important to note that the Tundra Times was not just significant to Alaska and Alaska Natives, but across Indian country, because at the same time that story was being told about the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the American Indian Press Association, which was then kind of an Indian version of AP, was taking all of Tom Richards' stories from Washington, D.C. and spreading them across Indian country. So its influence was far beyond Alaska. It was really a major turning point in how stories were covered by the press. I'm glad to see all the ownership opportunities in Alaska, and I think And like I say, you build on success. So success leads to other things, that, such as television.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a call now from another Alaska Native person who is well-known across the state in storytelling and reporting. Jeannie Green is calling in from Anchor Point. Hi, Jeannie.
Apparently they got it messed up. I'm actually Tracy. I was calling in to speak about Jeannie Green.
Okay, so sorry. Hi, Tracy.
That's okay. I was like, what? But
that's my mistake.
I was going to speak about her. Yeah, you know, when I moved up here, I moved to Alaska 20 years ago, got married, moved up here, and I had moved to Valdez, and I started out, I worked a little bit at the Valdez Star. And I didn't know anything about anything Native at all. And I moved out of the state shortly after that, and I started to become more interested because I wasn't in Alaska and wanted to be here so much, and I started to become more and more interested in the state, and more specifically the Native populations and all the just incredible variations of the Indigenous population here. And when I moved back up here, I moved to Seward, and shortly after that I met Jeannie Green. And as a journalist, as an observer, I have to admit, she just takes the cake. She absolutely shows, she shows in a very interesting way Native life. I don't even know how to explain how she does it. It's not just her charm. It's not just, you know, the, it's not just the way the show is put together, but it's the way that she presents the package. And it's fun, sometimes it's serious, but it's definitely informative, and definitely one of the things I have to say that has been a big influence on my view outside of National Geographic, I guess you could
okay,
say.
Okay, well,
that was, prior to that, that was the influence, you know.
Thank you so much, Tracy, for your comments. We're about out of time. Mark, I wanted to give you a chance to say something quickly in response to the importance of those things.
Well, Heartbeat Alaska is a classic example of people telling their own stories. It's real, and it's fabulous. It's just great fun to watch and inspirational.
And I think that's a good example of a way to get into storytelling in communities when it's not a crisis, or you're not reporting on some scandal of some time or some type or another. Thanks so much to my guest, UAA Atwood Chair of Journalism, Mark Trahant. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, Josh Edge and BD Trentine on phones. And thank you for listening. I'm Lori Townsend.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Mat-Su Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.